Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror podcasting from the Horrid Halls of Academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we are back to pick up a topic we put to the side almost 3 years ago, and we really did think about returning to it for a long time. As you should know from our last episode, we are revisiting the topic of witches. And when we talked about them last, which was in May 2015, you know, we were kind of like, I don't know what's next for witches. I don't know what we talk about next. And then, boom, Robert Eggers, The Witch, comes out. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, there seems to be this whole cultural movement towards the witch.
Yeah.
Just in the last couple years, I think it had been bubbling below the surface for a little while, and we'd always been interested in it. And I think a lot of our listeners probably have. But it's been very different this time, to the point where you can go find witch stuff in Urban Outfitters.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference. When, you know, punk went from an underground scene to being able to buy it, you know, at the Gap, that's very different.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And that's totally how fashion works, right? Is it mm-hmm. takes what's going on in the street and it manifests upward, contrary to whatever the Devil Wears Prada tries to teach you. That's the direction it goes in, is fashion is co-opted from the streets, from the cool people who are as edgy and as far from fashion as possible. And so, yeah, the figure of the witch is so hot right now. It's very mainstream, and I'm not mad about that.
No, I'm not mad about it either. And it was bubbling under the surface, as I said, for a while. And then in the last year, I'd say around Halloween, I saw a couple think pieces about why the witch?
Mm.
Why now? And for me, the stuff I've read in my own personal opinion is that it kind of comes out of the sense that we all live in a patriarchal society and, you know, father knows best and there are checks and balances and everything will be okay if you just trust in the system. It might not be perfect, but everyone who's supposed to be taken care of will be. And A, that was always a crock of shit. B, with, frankly, the election of Donald Trump, it was this galvanizing moment in North America and I think around a large part of the world where it's like, oh, the checks and balances don't work. Someone who rules never applied to is now in the ultimate position of power.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really scary. And that's when you start to look at alternatives. You start to look at marching, demonstrating, getting politically involved, but also rejecting a lot of mainstream society. And what is witchcraft, Wicca, anything like that, but a rejection of the patriarchal Christian norm?
That's right. And the films that we're going to talk about today really take a different and interesting and exciting tack on the subject, as we're going to get into. You might be familiar with a magazine called Rumor, but the September-October issue of the magazine last year was our 20th anniversary, and I was like racking my brain, just new in this position, being like, man, this one has to be a big deal. It was the issue where I unveiled new columns and a completely new approach to the magazine, or so I hoped. And I thought, what better time to feature the witch and to feature the history of the witch and how the witch has changed. So I've had some time to think about this. And these two films in particular share, they're very, very different films, but they share a certain tack that is really exciting and definitely worth a third installment from us on the subject.
So, you know, while a lot of people are kind of turning to these forms of New Age or occultism, things like tarot cards, herbalism, astrology, which are these really fun things but also have a really deep meaning for a lot of people, there has been a kind of co-option of some of the witchiness. And we started to see it a lot. We saw it a lot actually in the fall, right around the time that issue of Rumor came out. And obviously that was the time when a lot of the Harvey Weinstein allegations came to light. And then a lot of other allegations came to light through a lot of really famous and powerful men, some of which were known about, some of which were brand new. A lot of these people have been using the term witch hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's a witch hunt. They're out to get us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really scary to kind of see that term, which was used to prosecute the quote-unquote undesirables in Europe, in Salem, used as a term to kind of quiet these people telling their stories against really powerful people, in essence speaking truth to power. And their co-opting of this term, it just, every fucking time I see it, it pisses me off so much. It is so tone deaf. It is so unfair. And it feels like there's only a small group of us who are saying, actually, that's a bullshit term to use in this situation. Mm-hmm. This is not a witch hunt. Mm-hmm. And for them to try to use this term, it just, it is so off base.
It is. It's also deliciously ironic. If there's one positive thing I could find in it, is that to use the term witch hunt in that sense is to simultaneously acknowledge the fact that the original witch hunts were the persecution of innocent people, that, you know, these women should have been believed, and yet it's being applied from the contrary side. It's fucked up, but it also kind of makes me laugh.
And one of the few bright spots in culture during this period, for me anyway, was an op-ed written in the New York Times by a writer named Lindy West, who I am not related to, but she's a great writer. And the title of her op-ed was, "Yes, this is a witch hunt. I'm a witch and I'm hunting you." Mm. And it's a great piece, and we'll link it in the show notes if you need a kind of like solidifying moment. Nice. In yourself, because I think we all do a lot these days. But there is that sense that we have to keep fighting for this, and I don't know why we have to keep fighting this, why it has to keep being proven time and again that believe survivors don't misappropriate words and terms, and, you know, let people explore the things they want to explore.
It seems so simple.
Apparently it's not.
No. So here we are for volume 3 of The Witch, and we're going to unpack all that, because these movies are tackling that inadvertently, perhaps. I don't think the Weinstein stuff came out last year, and these films are from the year prior, but I do feel like they tap into that anxiety and that something was brewing.
Well, and if you look back at the figure of the witch in history, she was feared because she was a signpost of instability in a community, mm-hmm. or in a town or in a city, wherever it was. And now we're at a point where a lot of the left-leaning liberal progressives, we need to embrace instability. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why witches and witchcraft have become so predominant right now.
I think you're right. So with that backdrop established, we're going to tackle our first film of this episode, Robert Eggers' 2015 stunning, spectacular period debut, The Witch.
Philip Sif, you are wicked.
Catfolk. Does he really speak to thee?
Catfolk.
This wilderness will not consume us.
Catfolk.
Who's there?
Catfolk.
You've cursed this family.
Catfolk.
This is witchcraft.
She placed a curse on me.
Why have you turned against me?
I saw it.
Catfolk.
Your reign of evil.
Catfolk.
It's not safe. Not with them.
Think how I sense.
In 17th century New England, William and his wife Catherine take their family away from their Puritan community due to differences in opinion with regard to the New Testament. They build themselves a small farm near the forest with their daughter, Thomason, son, Caleb, and young twins, Jonas and Mercy. Soon after Catherine gives birth to a baby boy, Samuel, the infant disappears while under Thomason's care near the edge of the forest. Things go from bad to worse as the family's crops fail, and Caleb emerges from a hunting trip in the woods and a visit to a seductive lady's house, naked and delirious. The following day, Caleb suffers a bizarre seizure and dies, prompting the mischievous twins to accuse Thomason of witchcraft, something she had teased them with to make them behave. She counters the allegations back at the twins, and so William boards the three of them up in the barn with the goats overnight. The next morning, William finds the barn destroyed, Thomason unconscious, and the twins missing. Before he can ascertain what happened, he's gored by their goat, Black Philip. Now convinced of Thomason's witchery, Catherine tries to strangle her, but Thomason murders her mother in self-defense. Alone, in the wreckage of the farm, Black Philip speaks to Thomason and entreats her to sign her name in his book. She does so, with his help, and wanders naked into the woods where she joins a coven of witches, dancing and levitating around a bonfire.
I just got chills at that last part. Yeah. I was like, that sounds like fun.
I love the ending of this film. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we're going to get into it later because not everyone did. There is such a wealth of the ending explained as if it needs to be explained. Like, it's pretty clear to me, but we'll get there.
Yeah. And that being said, this was a really beloved film when it came out for a lot of people. A lot of people really liked this film. And it was a film that as soon as it came out, people were asking us to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And we just wanted to wait a bit. And, you know, you kind of have to give films their space. They have to exist in the world for a bit so we can talk about reception and all these other kinds of things that follow with it. And all that going to say is we get that there are a lot of people out there who don't like this movie.
Fair.
Who don't find it to be a horror film, who don't find it to be a good film. Mm-hmm. And as we always say, that's cool. That's totally fine. Mm-hmm. But like almost any work of art, any film, it's worth talking about. So we hope you'll put any kind of misgivings about the film, if you have them, to the side. And let's talk about what this film is, because it is so much. There is so much stuff. It is packed into every frame, even though in some ways it feels like a very sparse film. It also feels like a really dense film. Mm-hmm. And I went to see it at a preview screening with a friend of ours, and we both left just, we didn't quite know what to say about it. We went for a drink afterwards, and it was with Allison Lang, who wrote the Women with Guts book. And we were just kind of like, I don't know what to say about this film totally right now. Okay. I think I liked it, but and it's really only been, what, almost 2 years later that I feel like I'm finally really starting to unpack it.
Uh-huh. I saw the film in the summer of 2015. It came out at TIFF. I think that was the premiere. And so we got an early screening. That the staff of Rue Morgue got to go and watch an early screening because we were putting it on the cover of our fall issue. And and when that happens, what they do is they book a cinema at TIFF, and it's just you in there. So just in the primo seating in the middle of the back, there's maybe five of us, and the rest of the cinema was empty, and it was loud, and it was perfect, like just the perfect non-distracting environment to watch a film like this, where you really have to dive in, you really have to give yourself over to it. You've got to get the hang of the language, which is really tricky for some people. I have a really hard time with accents. My partner teases me about it, that like, I had to watch The Wire, the entirety of The Wire with the subtitles on, because I could not understand what the fuck they were saying. And they're in Baltimore, not 17th century New England. But anyway, we saw it at like 10 o'clock in the morning, and it was weird in the office afterward. This is definitely the kind of movie that you have to digest and unpack and multiple viewings. If it intrigues you, it's something you want to come back to. If not, then maybe it's a slog. But yeah, it's a fascinating film. It's a fascinating filmmaker behind it. Robert Eggers is a young man. This was his first feature debut. It has a really unique and captivating soundtrack. I actually interviewed Mark Corvin for the issue that The Witch was on the cover of, and he used very unconventional sounds. And even now he's established himself as a film composer who invents mechanisms for making interesting sounds for film. Like, we did a feature on him. He had invented some contraption that he called the apprehension engine. So yeah, he's all about making this wacky and out there. And then just the way the film is saturated, the way it's washed out with its color, I just love it. It's so world-building and yet very historically accurate.
Well, and there's not much of a world to build. I mean, the film opens with them, this family, leaving a community. And you don't really see a lot of anyone else.
No.
throughout the film. Mm-hmm. And I think to kind of start at that point of them being excommunicated could be a good point to jump into, especially in regards to their religion, the beliefs at the time, and what would lead a family to leave this place.
Right.
This place of seemingly relative safety, of security, and go off on their own.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe let's start there, because obviously the religious underpinnings to this film are really important, but we are talking about Calvinist Puritans in New England. That in itself is an offshoot of Catholicism that broke away from Europe, and they were like, okay, we're going to come over here and we're going to start things anew. We're going to start living the holy, holy, holy life that we feel like we should be living. So for William and his family, we're talking about an offshoot to an offshoot. And this is a religious belief that is so all-encompassing and so central to these people's lives that if they can't live outside of sin or what they perceive to be sin, they will just go. They will forfeit their safety and security if it means staying in the favor of God.
Well, and what I got from the film was that they were actually excommunicated.
Well, in that opening scene, there it does look like they're on trial, but it also seems like if he didn't want to go, he could have said the right things and stayed.
And what's interesting about that, and I agree with that, and that's kind of what leads to this like moral gray area with where the film already starts. And if you look at it like that, you know, excommunication from a community like this at this time, what I understand was that it would have a lot to do with pride, you know, the kind of pride of your objects, pride of self. And that was all the stuff you were supposed to do away with. Mm-hmm. You were supposed to kind of submit to God and this community. And during this time, God was omnipotent. He saw everything. He judged everything. And for William to accept this excommunication or lean into it, it's him still remaining prideful and leading his family out into a future that they couldn't possibly know or understand, especially as the film progresses and you realize that William is not good at all of the things a man at this point should have been good at.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Pride is definitely his fatal flaw, I dare say, if we want to use like traditional Shakespearean terms. I didn't mention the silver cup in my synopsis, but those who have seen the film will remember that at one point, because the crops are failing, William sells Catherine's silver cup and kind of lets Thomason take the rap for that until a certain point where he's like, no, fuck it, goddammit, I did it. And so pride is definitely a central flaw, but these Calvinist Puritans, I interpreted them as leaving the Commonwealth because William thought that they were too lax. And it had to do with the New Testament specifically, which I'm not super duper clear on. But from what I do know about Calvinism, Calvinism is a sect that emerged out of the Reformation. There was Lutheranism and then there was Calvinism. And there are several subtle differences between the two sects involving whether or not they believe that the body and blood of Jesus were actually present at the Last Supper and stuff. And I swear to God,
I wish I had that kind of time.
I do not have that kind of time to do that research and understand it. I did not.
No, just like back in the day.
Yeah.
To have been like, no, I don't think it was. Well, I think it was.
Well, we're going to start our own church, and it's going to be a church within a church.
I have enough time to decide that this is the hill I will die on.
It was a time of unrest and uncertainty, and there was increased secularism, and people were like, I am uneasy. And when people are uneasy, they tend to turn to things that provide answers. And so the most significant difference between Lutherans and Calvinists, for our purposes, is that Lutherans believe that humanity can control certain facets of their lives and they can earn a golden ticket to heaven, whereas Calvinists strongly believe in predestination. They believe that only people predestined by God can achieve salvation. You've either got what it takes or you don't, and you won't know until you get there. However, if you sin, you can forfeit your ticket. There's only so many seats in this heaven place, and it's as many seats as the fallen angels left open, I think.
This sounds more complicated than that Thing board game.
Yeah. You're not wrong. But But central to this, my point is that God can permit sin or he can damn sinners to hell. So basically, living without sin, everybody operates under the assumption that they are going to heaven and that they are blessed. There's no way to know, so you just do your very best and hope for the best and just not sin. But that said, it also created a lot of anxiety, which is partly what contributed to the hysteria and violence of the actual witch hunts that went on in Europe. And it's also why Thomason's family is so fucked up over the spate of tragedy that hits their household. It's like, they're this good and things are this bad, then they're probably damned. And if they're damned, there's really no hope for them. There's no point in continuing on. It's a very despairing existential anxiety. And all of that creates this pressure cooker that this family resides in.
It seems like in this microcosm of society that they have formed by leaving the community, it becomes so apparent that the things they held on to so dearly actually don't matter. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why this film works as a subversive take on religion and Christianity and is ultimately, for me, a really affirming look at the witch as a figure. For myself, as I've talked about before on this podcast, I was not raised in religion. I don't have a lot of emotional ties to it. So one of the few things I could kind of pick up on my vague understanding of the Bible, the Christian Bible, was that the opening is quite closely tied to me to the exile of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. Granted, they've got a couple kids at this point, but the notion of leaving this place of knowledge and safety and everything that you could want in this new world and being prideful enough to leave it. Mm-hmm.
So Eggers did extensive research for historical accuracy. And if you really want to kind of get into the nitty-gritty of some of the weirder, wackier, scarier tableaus within this film, I'm thinking specifically of the scene where Catherine, it's unclear whether or not she's kind of in a dream state. She's sort of dreaming that she's being reunited with her lost infant and she thinks she's breastfeeding it. And then there's this horrifying moment where you realize that her breast is being picked by a raven. And it's horrifying. It has like a very body horror, visceral, like, ugh, thing to look at. It's very shocking. It's very jarring at that moment in time. But that has a historical tie with what people understood of the witches, that the witch, being an anti-mother, would feed familiars with the blood from her nipples. Like, this is stuff that's kind of mentioned in the abstract, in the mythology of witchcraft that Eggers took and made literal in the film. Now, he admits to having a very clear idea of who is possessed and who is just losing it and what's happening, but he won't talk about it. He designed the film to keep us guessing, which is what podcasts like this are for.
For me, it's definitely towards the end. The two kind of age women, Thomason and her mother Catherine, are firmly in the grasp of something. Mm-hmm. And it's only Thomason at the end, by achieving that kind of status of being the last one standing and of having this choice to make and choosing it. Mm-hmm. You know, ultimately the rejection of this hard yet seemingly pure lifestyle for living deliciously. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a really kind of self-centered choice, but it is one that I would totally make.
I thought it was so harrowing that it comes down to a fight to the death between Thomason and her mom, where they're both damned if they do and damned if they don't. You know what I mean? It's either kill the other or die yourself. And if you live, then you're going to hell because you just killed a family member. Like, it's really awful. And I think the actress who plays Thomason, Anya Taylor-Joy, is just, this was her debut film. And that was in a very emotionally harrowing moment. And I felt it, man.
And I think, for me, the two kind of main male characters in this film, William and Caleb, they're just kind of there. You know, maybe Caleb is slightly possessed at the end, but they are, you know, figures who give in to lust, give in to love. I mean, Caleb definitely get those POV shots of Thomason's cleavage. And I don't think it's necessarily a specific incest thing.
No.
I think it's just like he's coming of age and getting those feelings down there.
Yeah.
And she's the closest person with nice boobs.
Well, yeah. And she's getting older too. And they make reference to the fact that, you know, Thomason's getting older now. It's time for her to go off maybe with another family.
So what I thought was interesting was there's very little visual cues of it, but except for one main one, but the on and off mention of apples.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you've got Caleb with the lie about the apples and going to see this apple tree he might have seen to kind of protect his father. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, what you've got at his death scene, he actually chokes up an apple,
mm-hmm.
this bloody, disgusting apple.
Right.
And of course, going back to the kind of Adam and Eve myth, it's the eating of the forbidden fruit, this apple of knowledge.
Right.
And I thought that it was interesting that both the father and the son were giving into this temptation, this lustfulness, this desire.
Right.
And even for William, while it's not as overt, he's constantly or semi-regularly saying to Catherine, like, I love you. I want this to work. And she's off on God and her silver cup. Mm-hmm. And there was something, even though I think William is a deeply flawed and wrong character, mm-hmm. there was also something really human about him.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think everybody is kind of sympathetic here.
Yeah.
Even Catherine in her situation, like, they are starving. And let's talk about crops for a moment. Because in my research, and this is another little like kind of a Easter egg from Eggers. This is, oh God, it's an Easter Eggers. He did extensive research, as I said, and the rot of the corn is ergot, which I had never heard of in my life, but it is a disease that infects crops and it makes people sick. And long-term ergot poisoning is known as ergotism. And it has been a proposed explanation of bewitchment.
Oh.
Because long-term exposure to this causes seizures, spasms, itching, mania, psychosis, headaches, nausea, etc. And it can also cause gangrenous ergotism, which is also known as St. Anthony's fire in the Middle Ages, because the monks of St. Anthony were really good at treating it. But, like, this was a thing in the Middle Ages. And then it wasn't until 1976 that an article in Science magazine speculated that ergot-tainted rye might be responsible for the accusations of bewitchment in Salem, that everybody is suddenly acting totally bonkers. And there's a number of scientific, like, counter-arguments, but Eggers mentions ergot by name in an interview about this, so likely because of its association. And I think that's important to note because the subtitle to this film, it's a New England folktale, and for me, it really reads like a folktale. When it comes to what happens to Caleb, for example, like you were just saying, you could explain a seizure, you can explain ergot poisoning, you can say it's epilepsy, you can say that it's this or that or the other thing, and then the apple comes out. And the apple is, it gives it kind of that supernatural spin, but at the same time, when you tell someone a folk tale, those are just the little symbolic ingredients that you just kind of dash in to make the story interesting.
So, yeah, The Witch has that subtitle, or the Vvitch, as you might want to say. And it's, as you can see in the poster, it's Eggers used the two Vs because another fun fact, the letter W was not widely used at the time.
That's right. So. That fact makes some people so mad. I've seen some people rage on Twitter that,
really?
Don't you write it like that. And it's like, well, that's the title of the fucking film.
Man. Yeah, it was the style of the time. So for me, looking at this film, and I had a lot of questions when I sat down to think and to write about this film. And oftentimes you have to start with these surface things that don't make sense to you right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of those was that subheader, a New England folktale.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously I was like, fuck, do I even know what a folktale is? So thank you, Google. So folktale is a tale, a story, something that is passed down through word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's different from a fairy tale in that it doesn't necessarily involve fantastical creatures and princes and princesses going through all these trials and tribulations. It can involve supernatural elements, but it's about real people. It's about, you know, a friend of a friend. It was kind of the olden day urban legend, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, where that situates this film is it kind of situates it in two different places. So if you think back to the beginning of the film, and there's this community, and they were like, thank fuck that crazy family is gone.
Yeah.
We don't want them here. Good luck to them. They're probably off and dead somewhere. And maybe, you know, in the spring, it thaws. They go off for a nice little wander, and they come across this little farm with some corpses, mm-hmm. and it's in a wreck, and they can't find anyone else. So could they have built this mythology of the witch, and this is the witch that happens, as some way to kind of reinforce their own beliefs and belief systems? So it's, again, it's like our modern day urban legends. It's the things you don't do to keep the next generation safe. Mm-hmm. This is why you do these things. This is why you listen to me. Because remember that family that went off and died? Mm-hmm. This is it.
This is why you keep out of the woods.
Exactly.
This is why you fear women.
Yeah. God, we're scary. But then it also led me to think about the stuff that the people who maybe came upon this crime scene, if you will, couldn't have seen, which is the ending, where Thomason and these fellow witches fly off. So to me, the film has this kind of feminist statement of this young girl, and we got to see her ending. We got to know this unknowable story, uh-huh. because we are allowed to see it. We are allowed to experience. We are allowed to be there for it. Mm-hmm. And for me, I find the ending incredibly powerful, because it's this group of women, and yep, they're witches, but they're also ascending. Mm-hmm. They're not descending. They're not hopping on their broomsticks and like flying around everywhere. Mm-hmm. It is this kind of gorgeously shot ascension. Mm-hmm. It feels very subversive to the kind of Christian mythology of the time, with any kind of painting of that era, which shows, you know, looking up at God and, you know, all these white people being like, oh my God, God, I love you.
Yeah, even the idea that you had to die to ascend. Mm-hmm. That this is kind of like a secular, anti-Christian sort of ascension. And after we've seen the ordeal that she's been through, so much oppression, oppression, oppression. And then here's Black Phillip being like, do you want butter? It's fucking butter, man.
Yes.
I scrape that on my toast. Like, talk about shit I take for granted. I don't consider that living delicious.
Would you like a nice dress? Yeah, I was on the Zara website today. And I also wanted to bring up this book I got last year, and I've only read bits and pieces of it, and I hopefully this year get through the whole thing, but it's a big fucking volume. But it's this book called Satanic Feminism, Lucifer as Liberator of Women in the 19th Century Culture by Per Faxneld. And we'll link this in the show notes because it's a pretty great book. It's a big, big book, but he talks a lot about how we can actually look at Satanism, the devil, everything as a subversion, as a liberator, because the only thing we have to tell us the devil is bad is this one book. And that's one opinion. And that's one thing. And he actually, in the chapter about witches, which is really, really great and was super useful for this episode, he references a book by a French writer, a male French writer called Jules Michelet, and it was called The Witch or La Sorcière, and it was published in 1862. And basically, this guy Michelet's take was that maybe the devil isn't that bad. Mm. And he's writing this in 19th century France. And it was kind of, you know, it's post-Age of Enlightenment, post-Renaissance, but it was still like, it kind of got him into some trouble.
Oh, I bet.
But it was a volume just saying like, the devil allows for certain things that we have taken away from women. Mm-hmm. So what if it's not bad? And asking those questions. And Faxneld goes into, you know, kind of taking apart the book and saying, you know, here's some really cool progressive stuff. Here's some of the stuff that was not so great. But for its time, mm-hmm. this is why it's a cool, important work. And I think for me, when I look at The Witch, I think of it as a feminist film because it is a condemnation and a rejection of a religion, a way of life that sought to not only oppress women, but as we see through this film, oppress everyone mm-hmm. in this film. Mm-hmm. You know, this family, it's like you've got different ages, different wants, different desires, and they are all so trapped. Mm-hmm. It is heartbreaking.
I also read the ending as absolutely feminist and empowered. I wanted to stand up and cheer. And to me, it was just because she had agency for once. She made a choice. And it's a choice that she never would have thought that she'd make, that her family would never even conceive of making. But they hadn't suffered the way she did. Her ordeal was unique and it was hers. And she took it and took it and took it, persecuted and persecuted. And then she chose to live deliciously. And to me, the ascension, it was just beautiful. And what I was seeing so much online when I was doing research about this was the ending explained. Why on earth would she choose that? Why?
Were those all written by men?
Yes. Yes, like totally unselfconsciously, I don't understand this decision, ergo it's confusing, ergo I'm going to make a 20-minute YouTube video on why she might have done that. And there would be speculation that, oh, she had no other options, her family is dead, the Commonwealth probably wouldn't take her back. It was either Satan or starvation. Her prayers weren't answered, so she turned away from God as like a criticism of God. To me, it is liberation with a capital L, and it cost her everything, but is everything even worthwhile in this context of such oppression? And that's what was so powerful to me. And I think it's amazing that you saw this with Alison Lang, because she is so connected to this film in my mind, because I don't talk about the Black Museum a whole lot on this podcast, but it's a lecture series by a Rue Morgue columnist by the name of Paul Korup, who he's been on the podcast before.
Yeah, and Mr. Cronenberg.
Yeah, he's the absolute best thing in the world. And every so often, the Black Museum does these debates, and our first debate was like King of the Ring, the best Stephen King adaptation, you know, and we had four teams come up on stage and they made their arguments and they had clips and you competed.
Came in second.
You competed in the first one, in the second one, which was
also came in second.
Best sequel. Yeah. So then we did one just last year that was Best Final Girl. And Alison Lang, along with her debate partner Simon Borer, chose Thomasin. And it threw this event in such a tailspin that everybody was like, oh, they are fucked. They are totally fucked. How are they going to defend Thomasin as a final girl? First of all, it's not a slasher. Second of all, third there, blah, blah, blah. It was this whole big thing. And of course, that's kind of Alison's style. That when she came into her first debate was the best sequels debate. And she had Exorcist 3. She was the total underdog. And she swept it. She won it. And she defended Thomasin as a final girl in amazing, fascinating, interesting ways that I could not hope to articulate here. But the way everybody attacked her on stage, the way everybody just kind of came at, this is ridiculous, Thomasin had no agency and no this and no that, it really blew my mind how many people missed that aspect. And I almost felt sorry for them.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, it's hard for me to relate to people who don't have that reading of this film. I respect completely not having that reading of this film, but they seem to get really angry about it.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just a different narrative. It's a narrative we're not used to. Mm-hmm. And if anything, I think we as horror fans are the carriers of that, like, fuck, we want something different. We want something new. Mm-hmm. And we get it and then go like, oh, I don't know, not this. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it pisses me off, especially as a female film critic, as a female film fan, I want to see a different female narrative. Mm-hmm. And that's what this was to me, especially those ending scenes in particular. I mean, the whole film, the visual style of it, you know, a lot of it, according to IMDb trivia, was shot in natural light. So it's got this kind of weird flat glow to it almost. It's completely unnatural while set in the natural world, which I really appreciate. But at the end, it becomes extraordinarily cinematic and also very artistic. And then the first time I saw it, those ending scenes as Thomasin goes to the coven and then ascends, it reminded me so much of my favorite artist, I think, ever, a Spanish painter by the name of Francisco de Goya.
Oh my God, that's my favorite artist.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
How do we not talk about this?
I don't know. I was totally considering getting a tattoo of yeah, man.
That's so fucking
anyway,
cool.
Sorry, go on.
But yes, and so Goya is an absolutely fascinating figure in the art world. He did a lot of stuff for the upper classes. He was, you know, lauded and did all this stuff. And then he started to go deaf. And so he holed up in his house and he started painting on the walls. And he would paint these, you know, portraits of witches and witches, you know, flying or, you know, listening to a black goat talking or giants eating, you know, children and all of these like horrific images. And he's got this kind of incredible mastery of technical abilities, but he also has this kind of distorted viewpoint. And one of the times I was in Boston before we went to Salem, the Boston Art Museum did this huge retrospective on Goya. And there's a huge Goya-based museum in Barcelona in Spain, and that's kind of my bucket list. Like, I want to go there just to go to that museum. Mm-hmm. And it just reminded me of this kind of subversive quality where Goya didn't see these people as bad. He didn't see them as evil. He saw them as different. And as someone who had kind of gotten his money, gotten his livelihood from this upper class, it feels like this kind of pure expression of something other, of something different. Mm-hmm. So we'll link some of his images, especially of witches, but the lighting, everything evoked his quality of painting mm-hmm. to me.
So I was complaining before that some people didn't see the film as the high-minded feminist liberation tale that I did, but some people did. And some powerful people did. This film was endorsed by the Satanic Temple for its, quote, declaration of feminine independence, which provokes puritanical American and inspired a tradition of spiritual transgression. The Satanic Temple actually partnered with A24, the film's distributor, to host screenings and have performances accompanying the screening. And they hope to use the film to explore ties between historical and modern bigotry and to inspire a satanic uprising. And I was like, holy shit, yeah, this is totally the film to do that. I think it's amazing that the film's distributor embraced that and got on board, because the Satanic Temple is an activist organization. And I was biting my tongue before when you were kind of going into that writer who was originally opposed to Christianity and was just writing about how the opposite of Christianity might be okay.
Oh, Jules Michelet?
Yes, that guy. So a little bit of history of Satanism, I think, is perhaps in order. The Church of Satan, as started by Anton LaVey, is a completely different thing from the Satanic Temple. It was founded in 1966, and LaVey came up with Satanism as like a philosophical counterpoint to Christianity, meaning that whatever Christianity tells you, do the opposite. Instead of turning the other cheek, you hit back. Instead of helping your neighbor, you do what's best for you. Stuff like that. Like, it was actually kind of cheeky. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't really a strict belief system per se. And I don't mean to offend any Satanists out there, but like, this is just kind of anti-Christianity, which is kind of a form of Christianity. So it's weird. But that kind of egotism is directly opposed to the idea of rallying politically around a common cause for social change. And so old school Satanists are actually kind of pissy at the Satanic Temple about that, because the Satanic Temple is an activist organization, and they basically use the icon of Satan to push back against aggressive Christianity and promote a separation between church and state in the U.S. So, for example, they erected a statue of Satan on Oklahoma Capitol Hill to protest the Ten Commandment monument, claiming that they had equal rights to expression in this manner. And fuck, that's fair. They did protests in support of Planned Parenthood. They set up a satanic nativity scene to counter the prominence of Christian nativity scenes all over the U.S. All stuff I'm totally on board with. The head of the temple is Jex Blackmore. She's their national spokesperson, and they're based out of Salem.
Oh, amazing.
I know. I hope I get to meet her one day.
Someday. Only we could go back.
Yeah. Anyway, I think it's super rad that they were able to embrace this film and help promote this film with that kind of political tenet. And Robert Eggers has explained in interviews that it's not that he didn't intend it to be a feminist tale, it's that it turned out that way and he leaned into it. And God bless that.
Yeah, some great feminist stories don't have to set out and be feminist. Sometimes they just arise from saying, actually, I want to fuck with the status quo.
Yeah.
And that's pretty fucking feminist.
Well, that's right. And when you have this story, like if Thomasin had of what? I'm trying to think of alternate endings that would have been as satisfying. And it's just,
she eats a crop and dies?
I would have been livid if anything other than what happened happened. It was so satisfying to me and still shocking to see. Even though I wanted it, I so rarely get what I want from horror movies.
Or in life.
Well, pour the wine.
It feels like for a film that is so deeply about the powerless, that to see one of them, probably the one you like the most, gain power, you feel empowered, or certainly I felt empowered when I watched it, mm-hmm. that there are different paths and you don't have to follow the one set out for you.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just turning your back on your church and starting over anew. It's burning it down and starting over actually anew.
With a cute guy with a great beard who says, I have butter.
So, hilarious fun fact about Black Phillip, and I love this. This came out of the rumor cover story, but they weren't able to find a black goat, so they used a white goat. They painted him black.
Oh.
It's a goat in blackface.
Oh.
Apparently, he was a real asshole, too.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, I've heard that this shoot was a complete nightmare beginning to end. They wanted to have several goats, but the goats weren't behaving because they're
goats.
Fucking goats. But Black Phillip in particular was a huge dick, and this was right around when Rumorg did their Dark Carnival convention, and we were like, what if we could get Black Phillip as a guest? Like, what if at the end of the weekend we just let him loose to tear down all the tables?
You know you would have had to wrangle him.
I wouldn't have needed to. I would have just looked in his eyes and he would have been like, yep. And I'd be like, okay, signing your book.
And that's how you became executive editor of Rumorg.
Shh.
So for right now, that's our kind of overall take on Robert Eggers' The Witch. And now we're going to move to a film from the following year, from 2016, The Autopsy of Jane Doe, directed by Andre Overdahl. And this already elicited some commenting, some excitement, just about a year and a half ago when we did our assessment episode of 2016. And I talked about The Autopsy of Jane Doe as one of my favorite films. And I think, Andrea, you agreed.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, I mentioned, oh, I'm loving this kind of secret witch film.
Yeah.
And so many people were like, what is it? And I was like, I don't know if I want to tell you, but now I want to tell you. It's The Autopsy of Jane Doe. And it is weird. It is scary. It is something pretty fucking special.
Let's talk about it.
Let's crack it open.
This is the autopsy of an unidentified female, henceforth known as Jane Doe. This autopsy will be conducted in four stages, beginning with an external evaluation, followed by an internal evaluation, the heart and lungs.
One thing's for sure, you're not going anywhere.
Hey, Dad, I think we should get out of here.
Everybody has a secret.
The body of a young, unidentified woman is found at a brutal crime scene. The body has no marks or wounds on it, so it is taken to the father-son coroner team of Tommy and Austin in the small town to determine the cause of death. As the two begin to work, increasingly odd and unexplainable occurrences happen. The trauma they find in Jane Doe's body, not externally but internally, doesn't make sense. The supernatural occurrences continue and build in severity, and the dead bodies in the morgue begin to reanimate, leading Tommy to accidentally kill Austin's girlfriend, Emma. Tommy and Austin soon discover that Jane Doe, the victim, was actually a victim of the New England witch trials in the 17th century, but was actually an innocent, and the torture and rituals inflicted on her body caused her to have supernatural powers. Jane Doe eventually kills both Tommy and Austin. The police arrive on the scene the next day to discover a bloody crime scene once again, but Jane Doe's body appears untouched. The police decide to move her body to the next district, implying that the horror may continue.
So this film was Andre Overdahl's second feature, I believe. His debut was the similarly visually stunning Troll Hunter, which I super love, and maybe the Faculty of Horror will get to one day. It's kind of a found footage creature feature, but the creatures look great. They're portrayed as very natural and but also very threatening. And so I feel like this is a filmmaker who has a really great grasp of tone and pacing and how to build dread.
And I think similarly in Troll Hunter, there's a real sense of time and place. Like the trolls in that film are very much based in Scandinavian Nordic mythology. Mm-hmm. And in Jane Doe, you have what kind of appears to be a very black and white setup for a horror film. It's a, you know, it's a morgue, it's a coroner's office, and oh no, shit starts to go bad. But it's actually deeply indebted to a specific time and place. And they're not in New England. They're not in the northeast of the Americas. They are, you know, much more central. So there is this mystery of this body. Mm-hmm. And as the film opens, you have Tommy passing on this occupation to his son, like it's a family thing. This has been in the family for a long time, and he's the next generation, so of course he's going to continue it. But as we learn from the opening scenes with Austin and his girlfriend Emma, that he actually maybe doesn't want to do that, and he has a different life plan. He doesn't know what it is, but he wants to go do something else.
Right. He's harboring that as a secret, and you always think that it's something that's going to come out. And I think it's actually one of the tragedies that both these men die having not fully divulged their secrets. You also get the sense that Tommy has some unfinished business about Austin's mother that isn't really fully tackled, and that just kind of adds to the tragedy.
This film has such a perfect tagline to it, which is every body has a secret.
Yeah.
And each character in this film has those secrets that they keep from each other. And because it's such a small cast, these secrets become increasingly important. And so one of the things that intrigued me and led me down my path of research was, what is a coroner? What do they do? Now, coroners actually originated in England in the 11th century, and their primary duty was to protect the financial interests of the crown in criminal proceedings. They were agents of the crown, of the government, of the king and queen at that time.
Right. Like, that's in the name, the coroner. Mm-hmm.
And then when you get into later times, so kind of during the witch hunt era, the centuries that that fell within, being a coroner, you know, exploring autopsies and death and all of those things, kind of fell out of popularity because it was about God and the sanctity of the body and what is that. And then as you got through, you know, the Age of Enlightenment and the Renaissance, they kind of came back into popularity as the desire to understand things scientifically became more prevalent. Now, in the U.S., some coroners are elected, some are appointed, and their main task, as I mentioned, is to determine the cause of death, the time of death, and the manner of death. And so it is, as the film mentions, it's not to solve the mystery, it's not to do the police work, it's just to understand the body and what happened to it that caused it to die. And oftentimes, if a death is not certified by this deceased doctor, they are transferred to a coroner and an investigation has to happen. Now, what I find particularly interesting about this film, to kind of start us off, is the notion of the outside versus the inside. So there's a lot of shots of the outside of this house, and it looks like kind of a nice, quaint, largish house in the middle of nowhere. And then as soon as you get into it, there's a completely different underground. It is technical. It is laboratory. There are offices. There are bodies down there. And that's really beautifully illuminated in the opening scenes when Emma comes to visit and she sneaks down there to surprise Austin and has to figure out, like, oh, this is actually what you do and you've kept this from me. Mm-hmm. Now, this also kind of comes into play as we learn a little bit more about the mother, who is not there. We learn very early on that she died. But the manner of death only kind of comes out later in that Tommy mentions that she was really depressed, mm-hmm. and he didn't know how depressed she was.
Yeah.
And it was only when she took her own life that he realized the severity of it. And then, of course, the title character, Jane Doe, it is her body, the underside of her skin, that reveals the trauma, the rituals, everything that happened to her. So the kind of outside view of a person or a place versus what is actually internal and what that hides.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember the first time I saw it. The word witch wasn't even in there. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why you were very reticent to call it a witch movie, to associate it with witchcraft, because you thought it'd be kind of a spoiler, because it was a really fun reveal for it to go there, you know, especially as when they kind of started off with they're speculating that a prostitution ring, and you're like, oh shit, this mm-hmm. is going to be some like SVU type shit.
Yep.
And then it just goes into a completely different direction that you don't expect. Nowadays, again, you know, we've given this film some breathing room before we've sat down to talk about it. And a lot of the literature I've read on it are just like, she's a witch.
Yeah.
Like, this is part of the plot and this is what happens. So when you first saw it, was that a surprise for you?
It was completely a surprise. And then when I went to do research on this film, I was actually shocked by how many people were like, oh, I totally saw that coming.
No.
And I think they give you enough misdirections. There's even a sense that maybe the death of the mother has something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that her death, while it informs the narrative themes of the film, is actually more of a MacGuffin. And a MacGuffin, which I think we've talked about on this podcast before, was primarily popularized in the films of Alfred Hitchcock. And it's something that presents itself as really, really meaningful, but actually winds up not having much to do with the plot except to drive the character
mm-hmm.
or a character. And so you can see that in something like Psycho, where Marion Crane has this briefcase full of money
mm-hmm.
and it drives her to leave the city that she's in and seek refuge at the Bates Motel because she's on the road. But then the money disappears into a bog.
Yeah. And it's not about her at all.
No.
She's just the device to get us to where we need to go.
Mm-hmm.
I also found it fascinating. The fact that I didn't see this historical witchcraft element coming into play is because the body of a naked woman, a dead naked woman, is it doesn't tell a story at all. It's only until they cut into it that they're able to glean all this history, all this trauma, all this past. On the surface, she's just it could have been someone young who died yesterday.
And what a perfect metaphor for the notion of witchcraft, witches, the witch hunt, is that, you know, I think, you know, the female population, we carry that with us to some degree, even though it's not necessarily externalized. We have this history of being persecuted, and we are still persecuted in many, many ways, in different ways currently. And I like that it plays with the metaphor of this really attractive female body just being there and being cut open, and you see the inherent trauma that can't be externally seen. But once you investigate, once you actually begin to empathize and become more involved with it, you begin to see in the tragedy and the misogyny and the fear that caused this pain and this fear and this trauma.
It builds up a person. I mean, Jane Doe is obviously a term that's given to an unidentified female body, but it also, the circumstances in the film make her lack of identity like really poignant, I thought, because she comes to represent all the women.
Mm-hmm.
She comes to represent the every woman who walks around bearing this weight. And when things happen, it's like, well, where's the evidence? Where's the this and that? It's like, the evidence is inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see it. I need to die and be cut open before you can actually unpack everything that I've been through.
And I think it gives bearing to a kind of filmic metaphor for any kind of unseen health issues or mental health
mm-hmm.
issues and anything that kind of has traditionally believed to have played a part in the witch hunts and witch trials in Europe and then in New England. And I like that the death of women in this film feels so predominant. Not only Jane Doe, not only Austin's mother and Tommy's wife, but also Emma. She is this kind of seemingly vital, charismatic figure who appears very briefly at the beginning, and then her death is, I certainly felt it really strongly when Tommy accidentally kills her because he thinks he's killing a reanimated corpse.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that it plays with the notion of women kind of constantly being cut down and silenced and their lives cut short.
Mm-hmm. Not to mention, how often did you think that that body was going to get up and do some shit?
Oh, constantly.
There were so many red herrings where it's just like, oh, he's leaning really close to her face. Something's going to happen. And she never moves. She never blinks. She never bites. I thought I saw that coming a mile away, and it never came. And it's so delicious, the tension.
And I think that speaks to a lot of the maturity of the script and the filmmaking and the performances. Now, they actually did have an actress in that role of Jane Doe. They also had a full body prosthetic in different stages so
mm-hmm.
that they can kind of sub them in and out. And there was a really terrific talk that Andre Overdahl and Emil Hirsch, who plays Austin, and Brian Cox, who plays Tommy, took part in at the Lincoln Center. And it's about a half-hour talk, and it's all on YouTube. So we'll link it in the show notes, because it is worth watching if you are interested in this film. And Overdahl talks about how they shot Jane Doe, because that comes up. Mm-hmm. She feels present. She feels alive, yet she's mm-hmm. not alive. And he talks about how he used the camera. And so he constantly shoots her straight on. And he talks about how that's very much a thing for actors. You shoot your character straight on, so the audience develops a connection with them. And I think it's Brian Cox who talks about, you know, the different angles of her head. When they lift it up, put it down, put it to the side, do this, that, and the other with it, how it would slightly change the expression each time. Mm-hmm. And how they kind of use that to build moments of empathy. When you got to kind of understand her story a bit more, you know, she'd be in a bit more of an empathetic or sympathetic situation with her head. Yeah. So,
and even later when she starts to get sinister, I was looking really closely, because you know how like Child's Play and stuff, mm-hmm. you see like the puppet has different heads and faces with varying degrees of severity to their brow and their expression or something. But she was always – the context shaped how you perceived her body, which I thought was amazing.
And then just in a technical way, they talked in this panel about how this actress perfected – a form of shallow breathing.
Well, yeah, she was a yoga instructor or something.
So she could do this for long stretches of time on a really cold surface in a big film studio in London, England. So mm-hmm. she didn't have a lot of stuff going for her, except that she could kind of control her body in a certain way to do it.
And she's not sexualized.
No.
At all.
No.
You kind of almost waited for the gratuitous money shot to kind of be like, okay, now we have to jiggle her tit or something. But it was all very clinical. Of course, they're not going to jiggle her tit, but you know what I mean.
Oh.
I'm not going to fondle the
Brian
body.
Brian Cox but... just giving it a shake. But I think what you have here is a story of a father and son who don't fully understand each other being forced to come to terms with this supernatural element that lives around them now mm-hmm. and the stakes that it gets to for them to have to agree to accept what is happening around them and understand that this is fucked up and we cannot understand this and we are going to have to do what we do, which is find out what happened to mm-hmm. her. And how it brings things to light, like one of the moments which I think really speaks volumes to the sensitivity and emotion of this film, is when the cat dies.
God damn. I don't especially like cats, but that scene really affected me upon the rewatch, and my partner and I kind of laughed about it, that like now that we're pet owners, we kind of can't take these gags in horror movies, which are predominant in horror movies, we kind of can't take the kill off of the pet early on the way we used to.
I love cats, so it was especially sad for me. And it's, you know, you see the cat brutally wounded by this unseen force and Tommy having to make the call of breaking its neck mm-hmm. and putting it to rest.
Yeah.
And him talking about that was the last thing I had of your mother's mm-hmm. and how you associate these things, these pets or these objects with the dead person. Mm-hmm. And that led me to think about the notion of the memento mori, mm. or a memory of the dead. And those were really predominant, especially in the research I had, in England from about 1500 to 1800. So still kind of in those, like, we love God days. And the use of the commemorative objects of the deceased were to allow them to have a life beyond what their life on earth was. So they were in memory, they were commemorated, they were and will be a part of some kind of life beyond their time on earth.
Yeah, like a material thing.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah. So Jane Doe's body, it is her own memento mori. She remains because she needs to exist as a reminder of her trauma. Mm-hmm. And it feels really powerful to think of it in that regard, because they kind of talk about in the film, like, they find a certain kind of poison or anesthetic in her system, a plant-based one, and they were like, that exists in New England. That's up in the East Coast. How did mm-hmm. that get here? So it's a sense that this body, through either government or political or, you know, jurisdiction means, has been transported through different places and wound up in these different situations causing trauma and death, and it will not stop. Mm-hmm. It actually also reminded me quite a bit of The Ring.
Right.
When Naomi Watts gets through all of this stuff and is like, ah, I figured out Samara. I understand her. And then the son is like, you let her out?
Yeah.
You weren't supposed to do that.
I love that about this film, too, is that I feel like at one point Tommy is like, okay, perhaps we can appease her. Perhaps we can do what you want with me, but leave my son alone. And so what she does is she inflicts her injuries on him one by one in graphic mm-hmm. detail. But then she still gets the son. Because why? Because fuck you. Just like The Witch, I love movies that end with a nice feminist fuck you.
And I don't think I would be satisfied by this film if it ended up with like, oh no, Austin killed his father. We're going to take him away and do all this stuff and blah, blah, blah. It needed to be that nihilistic and bleak because the witch hunts and the witch trials and the persecution were that fucking bleak and nihilistic.
Yeah. Nobody wins.
Nobody wins. And especially that you've got this kind of hand-me-down occupation of the coroner as an agent of the crown or of God or whatever kind of powerful force that exists in this world, this thing to give your body a meaning after death. And the sheriff who kind of comes in and is like, we need this tonight. We need this to happen now because I have to talk to the press tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, you know what? My body's not going to be played for that.
Yeah.
It is not going to be trotted out for display. It is going to be your biggest fucking nightmare. Mm-hmm. I like that it complicates the notions of good and evil because, you know, what they uncover, and if we choose to believe what the film uncovers, is that Jane Doe was an innocent. And whatever happened to her was because of the people around her who decided she was a witch and what they did inadvertently caused a malevolent force to happen. And just like Tommy and Austin, they're not bad people. They are extraordinarily likable, played by really good actors, particularly Brian Cox, who give these people a real heart and soul and depth. You feel it when Tommy makes that decision to sacrifice himself so that his son can live on, and he will not know what actually happened to his son.
No.
And it is tragic, and it is fucked up.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that in rewatching the film, maybe it's because I knew where it was going and I know what happens. The strength of this film is the mystery and the way the mystery unfolds. It unfolds beautifully. It unfolds within the flow of a realistic coroner's report where let's look on the outside. Oh, her tongue. Oh, her vagina. Oh, her wrists and ankles. Like that's kind of the surface level. And then they dig deeper and they find something else. And they dig deeper and they find something else. And permeating this mystery are kind of these really conventional haunted house style scares with the corpses coming to life and the fog rolling in and the jump scares involving the cat and the red herring involving the girlfriend. So on the rewatch, I felt like I was able to see this film's seams. I was able to see kind of some inconsistencies. Like indeed, if you go to IMDb, there's continuity gaffes abound. But the fact that you don't care, the fact that you don't notice on the initial watch because you're so engrossed in this mystery really speaks volumes.
And I kind of want to touch on the weather element in this film. There's a physical weather element in this film, and then there's some verbal cues about the weather. So I think most obviously what you get in the film is, you know, it starts and it's a nice sunny day. And then the more they cut into Jane Doe, the more they pull her apart, the more severe the weather gets. So mm-hmm. what they're hearing on the radio is, oh, you can't go outside. You have to stay put.
Yes.
And that's about when Austin is like, Dad, we should get the fuck out of here. Now, in Shakespearean theater literature language, that term is actually known as pathetic fallacy. And that's when you give an inanimate object or nature a kind of personification. So in Macbeth, they have a lot of stormy, dark nights. And that is to depict and amplify the unrest that is happening within the Scottish kingdom. Now, within Jane Doe, she is the kind of proprietor of this weather. She brings it on. And what you realize at the end, if you catch this bit, is at the end, the radio, which kind of plays on and off throughout the film, mentions,
well, it's going to be another nice one out there. Today's our fourth straight day of sunshine, looking at a high of 75.
And so you understand truly at this point, which I kind of assumed before, especially with the death of Emma, that there are two realities happening. Mm-hmm. There is the true reality where Emma's walking around trying to look for her boyfriend where it's sunny outside so they can go to the movie. And then there's the dark and stormy night where they are pulling this witch's body apart. Mm-hmm. And I think that also kind of plays into different elements, like the song that plays throughout the film, mm-hmm. Let the Sun Shine In, which, holy shit, is that a creepy movie. That's so creepy song. It's really unnerving, and it kind of goes into that great tradition of horror films using a happy, upbeat song as something really dark and sinister. Mm-hmm. And then also when Tommy talks about the nickname for his wife, Ray, like a ray of sunshine.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of all signifies this sense of the things that are purported and present as light and happy, as unblemished, as untouched, are actually the most traumatized and diseased.
Yeah.
Not through faults of their own, but through misunderstandings.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to pay the biggest price. So the fact that even though these two characters are, from my belief, from my standpoint, ultimately good, compassionate men, they have to suffer.
They have to pay. And that's why I take this film, again, it has a really uplifting narrative of a witch, similar to The Witch. I take it as a metaphor for feminism overall and feminism's grand trajectory and where we are with it right now is that, you know, initially it was like, okay, I want to vote. I want to own property. I want to have reproductive rights. I want to have maternity leave and equal pay. And then contemporarily, there's concerns about inclusion of people of color and queer identities. And then we have this like retributive aspect where we're fed up of covering up for sexual predators. And we want them to pay. We want them to suffer the social stigma that the victims of their crimes suffered. And I find it really validating to kind of see that suffering played out and expanded and not just kind of contained the way it always is.
Yeah, it's not Harvey Weinstein going off to quote-unquote rehab in Malibu. These are real traumas that should be played out and should be played out on a screen where we can all see them.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually, parts of this film reminded me a bit of that Lindy West article I was mentioning earlier in the show, where she talks about how the women coming forward now, they don't have masses of money. They don't have masses of power. They often don't have legal or police jurisdiction on their side. So all they have is their story. So they're going to tell them again and again and again. And to me, that is what the body of Jane Doe is doing.
Mm-hmm.
She will inflict this again and again and again. And who knows if anyone else got as close to understanding her truth as Tommy and Austin did. But it feels pretty fucking revolutionary. And in the Lincoln film panel I mentioned earlier, again, linked in the show notes, both Overdahl and Brian Cox talk about they're kind of leaning in towards this feminist take of the film,
mm-hmm.
and how it maybe wasn't their original intention, but that it's so clear now how they look at it and they see that this is a proper reading of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually felt nice, you know, it's not a gold star to them, but it just felt nice to see some white guys on stage go, yeah. Yeah, this is about the treatment of women, and it's about vengeance, and that's cool.
Yeah, it's fine. I didn't take this to be a hero, exactly, to get that gold star, like you said. I mean, this script was plucked from the annual 2013 Blacklist, and Andre Overdahl selected it in an effort to demonstrate that he wasn't a one-trick pony, that I can do more than found footage, and he's demonstrated that in spades here.
And I think even for the inconsistencies that exist within the film, I've seen it 3 times now.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time, it scared the bejesus out of me. It was one of the first films in a really long time that really freaked me out. And then I watched it again to review it for Rue Morgue. And then I watched it again for this episode. And it just, the more I watch it, the more there is to unpack out of it. And it has these really beautiful layers, and it's not as dense as The Witch, but I find it truly effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, it could be, yeah. There's a lot going on there. There's a lot of, like, conventional horror tropes, the little cuteness with the bell on the toe, a little ding-a-ling-a-ling. You know, the horror fans know that that's going to come into play later on, and it does, and it's totally satisfying.
Oh, my other favorite convention, which when I first saw it, the first time I saw the film, I was like, oh, this is going to fuck me up later,
mm-hmm.
was the mirror in the hallway.
Oh,
so
yeah,
you can see what's coming around the corner, because
uh-huh.
if you're pushing a bunch of big bodies and equipment around, you need those.
Those mirrors always weird me out.
Yeah.
Because they're distorted. They're like
yep.
intentionally designed to, I mean, it's technical to show you around the other side, but it's also kind of concave or whatever so that you can see it anyway.
And I enjoy that you kind of have the parallel with at the beginning of the film when Austin's girlfriend Emma is like, I want to see a body. Mm-hmm. I want to see it. And Tommy in particular and even Austin is like, you know, there are some things that you shouldn't see. And that is a lesson that they ultimately have to learn.
Mm-hmm. Tommy's like, let her see. And at the time, I was cheering for that. I was like, yeah, don't fucking coddle her because she's a pretty little lady and she can't handle it. Like, I dug that. I dug that that scene was included. You know, that I think after the first watch, I was like, what even was the point of the girlfriend? And I think that was it. I think it was to kind of draw a parallel of them both losing a love and that being especially tragic for Tommy to have accidentally taken away.
And I think it also serves to reinforce how othered they are from society because, yes, they give very warm, personable performances. So you're like, yeah, I know this. But the figure of Emma serves to kind of show, whoa, they are other because of the things they deal with every day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked a bit about this in our last episode on the thing of the inclusion of female characters. And we'd rather know female characters than a ditzy one. And I think Emma rides a nice line in between, like, she's a bit of a throwaway character, but she also serves a purpose to the narrative.
Yeah.
So I'm not angry at her, especially because of the overall message of the film.
Well, they made her quirky. They made her interesting. They made her, I don't know, I found her sympathetic, considering that he had plans with her and blew her off and wound
up getting killed. I'd be sad if I got an axe in the face.
I wouldn't like that.
No. So in kind of concluding about our talk about the autopsy of Jane Doe, I wanted to kind of bring it back to the patriarchal religious element and why this body could be seen as so upsetting to so many people. And it brought me back to the theorist and writer Barbara Creed and her theory of the monstrous feminine. And she's got a whole book on it. I think we've talked about it on this podcast before.
Must have.
Oh, God, I hope so. She writes about gore, physical gore, especially within bodies, as the loss of boundary. So the notion of understanding when something happens on another body or you see it, it becomes disgusting and other, and that's abject horror. Mm-hmm. And she uses a lot of kind of Freudian theory, which I'm not always the biggest fan of, but we're going to go with it for this, and that men fear women as a castrator, and that in that view, you have to look at monsters as constructs of patriarchal society. So the things that kind of scare us through monsters are constructs of a male-dominated society. So she even uses the iconic figure of the witch with her broomstick and her pointed long nose as having phallic elements, which are disconcerting and other and don't feel right. They are not the prim, proper noses and lack of broomsticks between the legs of the ideal woman. Mm-hmm. And what I think Jane Doe illuminates really brilliantly is what Barbara Creed kind of talks about and identifies as the biblical control and context, as the dirtiest thing about a body would be a dead body because it's a body without a soul. Mm. And I think that the autopsy of Jane Doe confronts that, and it confronts it in a really interesting way because it is a dead body. It is a lifeless body. It is a beautiful body. It is an aesthetically
desirable,
Western society, totally desirable body. And yet it becomes gross. It becomes disgusting. And what is truly terrifying about this film is that even though she's dead, even though she's cut up, they light her on fire. They do almost everything they can to destroy this body, she still lives. Mm-hmm. And in Christian kind of beliefs and mythology and all the rituals that seem to be conducted on her, there is maybe no soul. So we're left with the question of, okay, well, maybe she still has a soul and maybe that's what's keeping her alive, or maybe the soul doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of destabilization and subversion is what is pretty fucking radical about this film. Mm-hmm. And complicated and murky and dark and like a fucking bell on a toe when you don't expect it. It's unsettling, and it's the kind of way that I want to be unsettled by a film.
Yeah. it's nice to see a female monster who is not monstrous just in appearance. And maybe this is a little bit of a tangent, but I have to admit, I have not yet seen The Shape of Water. I have not yet seen it. And that is partially because when there were special promo opportunities to see it early, I had a terrible flu. I never got to see it. And then right after that, I was interviewed for a magazine called Suspira Magazine. I haven't heard what's going on with this magazine since. The interview was long ago. If I hear of anything, it'll be on my social media. But they were asking me specifically about monsters. And throughout the course of that interview, I realized that there are so many romantic narratives about a male monster being so sympathetic and so misunderstood, and they win over a pretty girl. And a male monster can win over an attractive woman because the woman is empathic and sympathetic and able to kind of see through their monstrosity to the person inside. And that treatment isn't often afforded in the other direction, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Unless it's in these narratives about the witch. Like, those are the female monsters that exist and are archetypal, and they're finally starting to be presented in a sympathetic light.
And I think what I like about the witch is that they don't necessarily exist within a romantic context.
No.
They don't exist around understanding love or the hope to find love. The
desirability of a male.
They exist in independence.
Power.
In saying fuck you to everything else and burning it to the ground. Mm. And, you know, I think in this day and age in North America, we talk about that a lot. About just being like, fuck this. We need to start again. This needs to burn to the ground. And I think these films have that. They are away from traditional narratives around female characters where they are expected to fall in love. They're expected to understand something other than them. And they're gloriously selfish. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in a good way.
Yeah, not in the Anton LaVey egotist Ayn Rand kind of way, but in the I've suffered and I'm sick of it.
I'm a do me.
It's safe to say that we're not the only ones to see the figure of the witch in this light, as we've already kind of discussed, but I want to mention another political organization to have adopted the figure of the witch in an empowering way. And one of the interviews that I did for the roundtable interview for the September-October 2017 issue of Rue Morgue that I was talking about is I got to interview a member of an organization called WITCH. And when I say WITCH, I mean like W-I-T-C-H, separated by periods to refer to the initials. And what this organization is, and there's several chapters throughout North America. The one that captured me was Portland, WITCH PDX, which seems to have a very organized and kind of really outgoing media embracing kind of attitude. They've got a really great website. They've got Twitter. They've got Instagram. They've got all that. So I reached out to them to talk, and of course they had amazing insights to offer as to what the figure of the witch is historically, what it is now, and why someone would adopt this long cloak and pointy hat and have that be a subversive figure. Now, one of the things I love best about this organization is they take the word witch and they treat it as an acronym, and every chapter of WITCH can choose its own terms to fill out that acronym. So for example, Portland, if you go onto the website, they scroll by. There's so many. There's wicked, iconic, triumphant crones from hell. There's we implode tyrannical capitalist hierarchies. There's we instill terror in corrupt humans. Like, whatever you can think of, they will embrace, and it's all good.
I love that.
It's so cool. Anyway, I just wanted to make mention of it that, and again, it's a political activist group. They are, you might see witches marching in anti-Trump rallies, in women's march rallies, Planned Parenthood.
And this isn't necessarily new. I mean, there's a book by Philip Carr Gohman and Richard Haygate, which is called The Book of English Magic. They actually detail an event that happened in the Midlands in England in around 1940, where a group of witches got together to hex Hitler.
Yeah.
This is, you know, the witch was a politicized figure constantly. I think we're embracing that now. And it's, you know, the generation who came before us. I know my mother was really into the occult and witches, not in a like extreme way, but she was always interested by it. And I think it's, you know, you get into your adulthood, particularly as a woman maybe, and you just realize, fuck, none of this works for me. Mm-hmm. I need a goddamn alternative. Mm-hmm. And so it's like generationally, we pass these stories on, we pass this angst and this anger on, and we find ways to push it outwards.
So yeah, this is our third episode on witches, and I feel like we've talked about some hard-hitting films, we've talked about some hard-hitting themes, but this is the age of the witch, man. She is so hot right now, and the movies coming out around her are not ignoring the fact that there is history to that, that there's power, that there's empowerment to be had from audiences through the figure of the witch, and it's really exciting.
And both of these films were made by men in script, in direction. So it's also incredibly intersectionally feminist, I think, in a certain way, in that men can get into this too. It's not that hard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, lean into this, guys. You can be part of this conversation, as we've proved through two films we have, I think, both labeled as subversively really fucking feminist. Mm-hmm. I feel like I need to go, like, further to witches. I need to, like, keep going. I'm not done with it yet.
Okay.
And I just got a message via broomstick from our dear friend Kevin Lynch.
Kevin Lynch? Wait.
You remember him. From? Yeah, from Salem Horror.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He invited us back to Salem Horror Fest this October.
Oh, my God.
Do you want to go?
Should we go?
I think we should fucking go.
I think we should hop on our broomsticks and return to Salem.
Well, I would love to. How does the weekend of October 12th sound?
I'm down.
Amazing. Let's go. We're going to be there.
There it is.
We are going to be back at Salem Horror. We had the best time last year, hopefully, as you could hear in our American Psycho episode. So we're going to be back the weekend of October 12th for Salem Horror. And we're going to be announcing more details about what we're going to be doing, about how we're going to be doing it over the coming months. So we're going to be really excited to share that with you. So to get dibs on all of that good stuff, make sure you're following us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and also Salem Horror Fest. Follow them on their social media. We'll link those again in the show notes so you can have easy access. But I couldn't be more pleased to be heading back there.
I know. It was such a highlight for me last year to get to travel somewhere with you, to get to do a live episode, and to get to meet our fans and listeners from really far away. People traveled from far and wide, and it meant so much to me. It was amazing to meet you all. So I hope some of you can make it out. I know it's early yet, but it's a lot of time to make plans to come on out there, and it would be wonderful to see you guys and meet you face to face.
But in the meantime, we have another month ahead of us and another episode. And this time, we are going to be venturing back into science fiction horror. But this time, we're not going to stay in an Arctic base. We're going to head to actual space.
And we're not talking about Leprechaun in space. We're not talking about Hellraiser in space. We're going to talk about Event Horizon and Sunshine, a pair of movies that take place in outer space. And, you know, we talked a little bit in Alien about the isolation, about the claustrophobia that can happen. But these films take a very unique tack on what evils might be not only supernatural, but otherworldly. And I'm really looking forward to tackling that.
They are two of my favorite, fun, weird, dark horror films, and I'm really excited to talk about both of them.
It's going to be good.
So yeah, until next time, we're going to cover ourselves in the blood of an unbaptized baby boy.
Yeah.
And
I have one right here. Here we go.
Oh, that poor intern. I'm going to go get the knife. But until next time,
office hours are closed.